I imagine that song as a prayer of well-being and traveling mercies spiritually and physically for all those who return from war and try to make their way to peace. Hansel and Gretel found their way home by following a path of bright white stones in the darkness. The story goes that a woodcutter and his wife lived in a simple home at the edge of a forest. Times were hard and there was not enough food to sustain all four members of the family, so the woodcutter's wife proposes that they take the children into the woods and abandon them there. They don't write children's stories like that so much anymore. Luckily, Hansel and Gretel hear this and they quickly make a plan for survival. Hansel goes out and fills his pockets with smooth white stones. The next day, as the woodcutter and his wife lead the two children deep into the forest, Hansel hangs back. He carefully drops the white stones on the ground as he goes, leaving a marked path to guide them back home. Sure enough, the adults manage to leave the children. Night falls and the moon rises. Hansel and Gretel are scared, but they make their way back out of the woods, following the shiny stones that gleam white in the moonlight. There's more to the story. You probably know it. The woodcutter is overjoyed when his children return, but his wife insists that they try again. The second time, they mark their trail with breadcrumbs as they enter the forest, but the breadcrumbs are eaten by birds. Later, they're lured into a trap by a devious old hag, but they use their wits to escape once more. And eventually, the two children return home to their father. He is racked with grief about the terrible choice he has made and overjoyed to see his kids back, and the family lives happily ever after. Smooth stones mark the way home to safety. I wish our neighbor's son had had stones like that when he returned from Iraq. He never made it all the way back from the war. Not really. And now he's gone. The house up the street from us, three houses north, is being flipped. A grandmother used to live there. Her son went to war and never fully returned. Her grandchildren were my son's classmates. Sometimes there were disturbances down the street, loud voices that carried in the night, screeching car wheels. Then a few years ago, we learned that our neighbor's son had taken his life. Our neighbor stayed for a while. The house fell into disrepair, and then a for sale sign went up into the overgrown grass. The grandmother and the grandchildren have all moved away. We never knew them very well, though we expressed our condolences and we volunteered in the classrooms of those kids. I think of all of them when I pass that house. There's a flagpole in the yard that no longer has a flag. The construction vehicles come and go now, repairing the roof, repainting the shutters, tidying up the landscaping. It is all too easy to smooth over what happened. A soldier returned to the United States after the war, but never really made it back. What smooth stones might we have offered him in gratitude for his service? How might we have better marked the trail leading out of the dark woods that we asked him to enter on our behalf? The answer to those questions matter a lot because the lives of those men and women matter. If we ask people to do the work of war, all of us ought to do what we can to help them return to a life of peace. And it matters because the circle of harm extends past those who experience war directly. There was yet another shooting this week, another mass shooting in a public place. And this time the alleged shooter was a veteran who also appears to have been affected by the war in which he fought. For so many reasons, we need to learn to recognize those smooth stones, the ones we can use to mark the pathway home to physical and emotional well-being. Years ago, I read a book called The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien. I love the story, the title story in this. It's like a book of short stories. It begins with a litany of the things soldiers carry on their bodies and describes the weight and purpose of each object. They carry helmets and guns and ammunition. They carry food supplies and photographs of people back home. Some carry specialized equipment, a medical bag or a communication device. One carries a Bible. Another carries letters. The young man with the letters is named Jimmy Cross. He's the leader of the group, and he carries letters and pictures of a young woman from home named Martha. At night, he takes out his letters and rereads them, running them through his hands until they are soft and supple like pieces of fabric. He takes the letter and holds them in his hands, and he imagines that Martha loves him. In one of the letters, she sends a stone that she has found on the beach. After reading the letter, he places the stone on his tongue. He turns it over in his mouth again and again as he marches through the swamps and the grasses, leading his men across dangerous terrain. Jimmy Cross's love is a stone, reminding him of what's on the other side of war. It ties him to a life that's a world away, and it helps to keep his spirit alive. I actually don't read a whole lot of war fiction, but there is one more book that I particularly love, Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five. Vonnegut was a college student when the Second World War started. He was in a ROTC program, but was fired from ROTC, and kicked out of school. With his deferment voided because he was no longer a student, he knew he was eligible to be drafted, and so he enlisted. Vonnegut ended up a foot soldier who survived the bombing of Dresden, Germany. He was captured and spent his time as a POW in a converted slaughterhouse. After the burning, when the city was flattened and tens of thousands of civilians had died, he went home. He returned home and found work as a writer. He started a family, intending always to write a story about Dresden. It took him decades to do. About this process, this long process, Vonnegut reflects in this novel, which is very autobiographical. The narrator in the book says, "Over the years, people I've met have often asked me what I'm working on. And I've usually replied that the main thing was a book about Dresden." The passage goes on, "I said that to Harrison Starr, a movie maker, one time, and he raised his eyebrows and inquired, 'Is it an anti-war book?' 'Yes,' I said, 'I guess.' You know what I say to people when I hear they're writing anti-war books? 'No. What do you say, Harrison Starr?' I say, 'Why don't you write an anti-glacier book instead?'" Vonnegut has rather a dark sense of humor. What he meant, of course, Vonnegut writes, was that there would always be wars, that they were as easy to stop as glaciers. Vonnegut believes that war is an inevitable part of human existence. And I confess that I do too. But I also believe that people of faith are called to be peacemakers in the world. I believe religious institutions ought to be engines of peace, which means that our job is to tend the pathways that lead from war to peace, that avoid war in the first place. We tend the pathways that lead from conflict to healthy connection, even if we don't believe we can put a permanent end to war. Sometimes it begins by learning to set aside the tools of war, laying down our sword and shield, because the things we carry alter us. They recreate us in their image. I heard a beautiful reflection on the radio once, inspired by Tim O'Brien's book, The Things They Carried. It describes the experience of one combat veteran, a man named Benjamin Tupper. He said, "Most of the physical items we soldiers carry are owned by the government, like body armor and weapons and helmets. These are unceremoniously returned to Uncle Sam as we outprocess from military service. But the emotional baggage is ours to keep. The memories are packed deep inside our own private war museums. Sometimes the outside world gets a peek at these painful artifacts when they rise to the surface, manifested by bouts of depression, rage, or guilt. Like most combat veterans," he says, "I kept many of my post-war idiosyncrasies private for fear they might alienate my friends and family. If I aired them, I feared I'd receive an impromptu intervention and be dragged off to a mental hospital for further evaluation. A good case in point is the anxiety I still feel at being outside arm's reach of a weapon. I know it's absurd to fear that a squad of Taliban may be lying in ambush in my suburban neighborhood, but when an event or sound or smell recalls a moment at war, my anxiety trumps logic. So when I came home 3 years ago, I bought the exact same model of combat shotgun we carried in Afghanistan. Then I bought the same M4 carbon rifle, complete with a combat reflex sight, and an M9 pistol, identical to the one that never left my side over there. Now I keep it in my truck. I stuff the shotgun under my mattress in case the Taliban attack at night, and the rifle is positioned at the ready in my office. No one, not even my wife, knew I had woven the security blanket of weapons to cover me from home to work and all points in between. No one knew, that is, until a couple of months ago, when I spoke to a group of student veterans and their faculty advisors. One Iraq War veteran in the classroom confessed he felt alienated and vulnerable back home, unarmed and defenseless. In an attempt to show he wasn't alone, I revealed the secret of my personal arsenal. Right after I said it, I knew I'd gone too far. I expected the students and professors to lean back in their chairs and nervously eyeball the shortest path to the exit. Instead, one student stood up and pulled out a large hunting knife he'd concealed on his waist. He said when he turned in his M16, he began carrying the knife, and not a day had gone by since he returned from Iraq that he didn't carry it. And then a professor reached into his pocket and pulled out a tube of chapstick. He said the day he left his job as a police officer, he had to turn in his pistol. He also moved to carrying a concealed knife. After a couple of years, he mustered up the courage to transition from the knife to his lethal tube of chapstick. He trained himself to accept the chapstick as a protective talisman. It provided the peace of mind he'd previously achieved from the knife and the gun. For 5 cathartic minutes, he writes, this conversation among veterans of the military and law enforcement sounded like a chapter from Tim O'Brien's book, The Stories Warriors Never Tell, for Fear Civilians Will Never Understand. Ed Nicholson gave soldiers fishing rods to carry, and he gave them hope. Nicholson is a 30-year veteran of the Navy, and he's also the founder of an organization called Project Healing Waters. He was at Walter Reed Hospital getting cancer treatment several years ago and saw many soldiers who had been badly wounded in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He thought, I want to go fishing. Maybe some of these guys would like to come too. He invited first one soldier and then more. Today, his organization has taught thousands of wounded soldiers to tie flies, make custom rods, and to fly fish. They spend time in rivers and in lakes in the company of people who share their experience, people who care for them without judgment. On the water, in the flow of the river, they find a measure of healing. They find friendships and pockets of peace. One man who lost an eye and part of his face to an IED said, I know so many men who've harmed themselves, who couldn't recover. Ed has saved a lot of lives. Another says the river washes away his scars, not the outer ones, but the internal ones, the ones that are harder to see and take longer to heal. For these men, the pathway back to some measure of internal peace is marked by a riverbed, a fishing rod, and a caring community. There are lessons for all of us in these stories, all of us who would be peacemakers. We too can muster the courage to set aside our weapons, the tools of attack to which we habitually turn when we feel threatened. What are yours? Like Lieutenant Cross, we can pause to remember what we love, what gives us hope, allowing that hope to sustain us when we are navigating treacherous terrain. We can carry reminders of our love on our bodies, in our bodies, reminding us who we are, what we are, and why we are here. And like those men and their waders standing together in streams, casting for fish and waiting for a tug on the line, we can build networks of connection and care. We can create places in which it's possible to acknowledge the wounds we have sustained and orient ourselves toward healing. We can find places of stillness and beauty and flow. We can master new tools, the tools of recovery that point us in the direction of peace. This day and always, may we tend to the stones that mark the pathways back to peace, so that all of us, veterans, civilians, citizens all, can find our way home to love, to connection, and to well-being. May it be so, today and always. Amen.